Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Martinson. It is December 19, 2018. Hey, listen, we are here today talking with Dave Collum about his year in review, and it's continuing our annual tradition. Listen, it is the best year in review in the business, and it's, listen, in order to know where we're going, we got to figure out what just happened. What better than a gigantic romp through where we've just been? Now, for those of you unfamiliar with Dave, he is professor of chemistry and chemical biology at Cornell University. And in addition to his academic interests, Dave authors this macroeconomic assessment entitled Year in Review. It's hands down, listen, people, the best synopsis of anything and everything that mattered in the previous 12 months. And Dave's latest year in review can, once again, thankfully, be found in full and all its glory at peakprosperity.com, where you can also download a PDF for your offline reading pleasure, wherever you happen to do that. I'm excited to have him with us now live in order to expand on these really excellent insights. David Collum, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you very much. You think this is a Friday upload? Is that,
Absolutely.
Is that the target date?
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yep, we're going for Friday.
I'm thrilled to be here. We've been doing this for years, and you know, we go back probably 20 years back on some, you know, Doug Nolan's chat board or something. It's been a long time.
Well, we're both celebrating 10-year anniversaries this year. Ours is for the 10th year since the initial release of the Crash Course. You, for being the 10th official year, I guess, of your own amazing year in review. So, congratulations on that.
Yeah, it's you know, I feel like I pull my brains out through my nostrils like an Egyptian when I do these. So.
All right. Well, listen.
It's hey, painful.
as you painfully reflect back, and given the ultra wide ranging views on display in the year in review, Dave, what are you most surprised to be here discussing with me yet again? That's not changed since last year, or maybe since we started.
Well, you know, everyone thinks the markets are now correcting. You know, the correction I think both you and I expect is so large that this is just a drop in the bucket. This is the vibrating puddle in Jurassic Park, right? This is not the big one.
Yeah.
And so what's amazing is that this recent romp, which has lasted now almost 10 years, is the only gigantic bubble that I'm aware of in which the storyline behind it is just complete garbage. So, you know, every other bubble, there was the tech bubble, you say, well, tech's just amazing, and the 20s bubble, and you say, wow, we just invented electric powered everything and cars and planes. And so there's always a great, great story. And this particular bubble, which they ran for 10 years, is central bank's going to print money and cover our backs, right? That's the stupidest goddamn plot line I could ever imagine, right? That's just dumb.
Well, it is just dumb. And here we are again. So I want to get into all this. We're going to look at the debt and the economy, all these other things, which are what you're alluding to is that there's really no narrative to support this one, right? So we have the tech narrative. Hey, the internet, it was transformative. You know, a lot of dumb things got done on the back of the credit bubble that Greenspan blew back there in the late 90s. But before we get in there, we got to get through the caveats. Dave, you've described yourself as one 1,024th economist. What does that qualify you for?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Everyone has at least that much economist in them. I'm a big believer in the 10,000 hour model. And so, we can get into it if you want, but you know, people ask me about global warming and I say, I haven't spent 10,000 hours, so my opinion is not worth anything. And my wife gets mad, but you know, I think I've got the 10,000 hours logged in trying to understand markets from sort of a 35,000 feet perspective. It's not, you know, it's not that I understand them the way some of these serious Wall Street guys do, maybe, but it's from standing back and looking at it and trying to take a wide angle lens view and understanding it in the context of history. So that's semi-qualifies me, and I'm pretty good at taking complicated problems and turning them into stupidly simple metaphors and stuff like that. So,
well, maybe we share that same trait. That's really my only addition I can offer to this. And I tell people, I'm not an economist, but I play one on the internet. So, Dave, you've also described yourself as a permabear. I've done the same thing for myself. But more subtly, I think I'm actually a perma-skeptic. And of several ideas. One is the idea that debt is the same thing as wealth. Another is that you can print up prosperity via central bank mechanisms. Or maybe I'm a skeptic of the idea that the Fed's Overton window is near wide enough for the many predicaments we face. What are your thoughts there?
Well, yeah, I agree. In fact, one of my big concerns is when it's time not to be a skeptic, you and I are going to be so scarred. We're going to have to sort of crawl out of our little lairs and say, you know what, the birds are chirping and you know, because the world's going to look like it just burned down. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have to know when it's time. Now, what happened was in 2009, everyone says, you know, people sell at the bottom out of fear, right? I was in cash in 2009. I failed to buy at the bottom out of greed, and the greed was, so I was salivating. But the greed was is that history showed that we were at a historical fair value in 2009. People think we were in some depths of deeply, deeply discounted shares. That's just baloney. And you can see it on one of the things I did this year more than any other years. I just banged on the valuation issue because I said, I just got to lay it all out there this year so that when we finally do regress to and through the mean, people can say, geez, I read that somewhere, right? And yep. So we never got beyond fair value in 2009, and history says we were going to. So I blew it by saying, you know, we got more downside. You can't just regress to the mean. You got to go below it. And then the Fed jumped in. And they did something that I have yet to find a single person claiming credit to have seen, and that is they dumped $20 trillion into the system. And I remember, you remember when Bear Stearns got bailed for $30 billion, and it was mind-boggling. And now that's a quaint number. So for them to the Fed and central banks to dump $20 trillion was so unprecedented that it caught me on my heels. So I wrote out this market. I sort of sat on the sidelines. I've been watching this in amazement and maybe, you know, hoping for some schadenfreude at some point. But this is the one cycle I played really sort of, I would say, poorly, even though I carried a lot of gold up until, you know, did okay for a while. But
yeah, I'm in the same boat, and we've been in the same boat. We've been preaching safety and security for a long time. And let's be fair about this, too. 2009, we saw the central banks start to dump a lot in. And by 2011, they'd unwound that. Got down to zero new additions. But then they freaked out and threw more in. I thought, well, that's it. QE2, that's got to be the end. How dumb can this get? And of course, you know, a couple more cycles of that. 2016, there we were. It looks a lot like it does now in early 2016, late 2015, right? Emerging markets going into bear market equity territory. We've got outflows, currency gyrations, skyrocketing interest rates at the margins. It's coming towards the center. All of that reversed one morning at 2:30 in February, and everything went the other direction. Now we have the data. We see that the central banks in 2016-17, largest additions to their balance sheet in the entire cycle, even as they were saying, everything looks good, unemployment, you know, they were saying that the nice palliative statements, but what was really happening was they were putting emergency levels of liquidity in. Let's talk about 2019 in that context. They are all publicly committed to not doing any more of that. Do you believe them?
No, but I'm not, I use a King Canute allusion this year, in which Canute stands there and says, watch, I'll hold back the tides. And then they come in, he says, see, nobody can hold back the tides. And so I think it's kind of a King Canute moment where they can hold, you know, for a while it can look like they're pulling it off. But at some point they can't pull it off. Regression of the mean will happen. And so it kind of feels like this one's real. And my biggest fear is that they'll somehow find a way to make it stretch over a dozen years and really crush us with the scariest of all variables, the consumption of time. Mm-hmm. So a fast collapse gives people who want to buy deep value opportunities a great opportunity. If they just grind the thing for 12 straight years, nobody wins. Nobody wins under those market conditions.
Well, maybe Illinois. Oh, no, probably not Illinois.
Yeah, I think Illinois has already lost is in the locker room taping up their wounds. Yeah, exactly.
So for those listening, what I'm referring to is that you and I, everybody listening, is lost because we lost 10 years of interest income, which is about $1 trillion missing dollars that did not flow into helping our children pay off student loans or to start businesses or any of that. That trillion flowed to the big banks. What did they do with it? Ah, record bonuses, you know, the usual story, right? But that decade is lost and it killed the pensions, all of which are underwater. So, Dave, I know you wrote extensively about pensions. How do you think the central banks or the Fed in the U.S. sense, how do they go about addressing that? Do they do it directly or do they try indirectly by propping markets and hoping, you know, fingers crossed this all works out somehow?
Well, the market prop won't work now because we just propped the market and the pensions went from poorly funded to pathetically funded. Mm-hmm. So if a pension in, you know, what was it? There are pensions that were in 2012 were funded to the extent of about 85%. Now they're funded to the extent of 35%. That's after one of these roid rages. So what's another roid rage going to do for these guys, right? They're dead. So I think the pensions are toe-tagged and bagged. I don't think there's any mathematical way for the pensions to grow or tax their way out of the mess they're in. I think it's a done deal. And then the question comes down to who gets screwed. And I think we might see pensioners get crushed, and then there's going to be people who are just destitute, right? They'll be eaten out of dumpsters. Or the model that I picture the most is some goofy model in which the feds pretend like they're just loaning the states money to put in the pension funds, knowing the states will never pay them back. Hmm. And that's so they'll monetize state debt. And that's going to tick me off. I mean, that's going to, you know, there are some massively overpaid pension plans across the country. There's ridiculous, you know, there's people retiring on $800,000 a year in public service, right? That's just crazy. There's no chance I want anyone paying that tab, anyone who didn't incur it. If the state wants to pay it because they agreed to it, that's fine. But I don't want that washing up on my doorstep.
Yeah, well said. You know, one of the things in this year in review, like others, so many great quotes packed in. Here's one that really stands out for me from Tony Deaton, the founder of Edelweiss Holdings. Quote, "We have abolished the idea of failure, nature's cleansing mechanism. As a consequence, we've lost real economic vitality. We've substituted finance for industry as the locomotive of economic growth. In GDP terms, hey, it looks terrific, but it's neither enduring nor real." End quote. Great quote there. I mean, that's really what we're talking about is this institutionalization banishment of failure. But what do you get when you stop that process?
What you do is it's the equivalent of like hanging on to a gangrenous leg, right? It just doesn't work well in the end. And so you get all sorts of zombies. There's the classic zombies of companies, which the definition of zombie, like there's a definition of zombie, right? But there is. Basically, it's a company that can't pay its interest payments with its cash flow. So it has to take out debt to pay its interest payments. That thing is dead. That company is no longer a financially viable institution. The question is how long they stay walking the earth, right, before someone puts a bullet in their head like in a zombie movie is totally up in the air. But they're dead. They're not coming back. And at some point, their productive assets will be auctioned off on some courthouse step somewhere. But as long as the feds keep propping them up, they sort of walk around doing damage. The zombie metaphor works perfectly for me. And so when it finally gives way, all these mistakes that the market has made because of the excess capital that's been dumped into it they'll surface, right? Bodies will be floating to the surface before we're done.
Yeah, and I guess the idea there is that I think some people are holding on to is the ultimate Fed put. Can the Fed keep all these different zombies alive? You know, a big one in my book, because I study it closely, is the shale space. You know, these shale operators have not made money on a free cash flow basis since they started. Their so-called break-even prices are a complete fantasy or fiction or fraud, depending on which F you like. And they are kept alive.
There's another one I like more.
What's that?
The bomb. Yeah.
Yeah, that one. So these, you know, this idea, let me take exception with Tony and how can I, because he's just so famous. But he says we've abolished the idea of failure. Maybe we've just, instead of abolished the idea, what we've just done is we've just delayed a much larger failure. Would you agree with that?
Well, I would interpret Tony more literally, and that is we've abolished the idea of failure, but we haven't abolished failure.
Not the reality of it. You got to spend some time with him, didn't you?
Yeah, as Jim Grant said, I think I quoted this one where he says you can change what people think, but you can't change what is. You know, he's got this. So Tony's a real smart guy, and he's old school, right? And in Switzerland, he manages old money. Mm-hmm. And his goal is to carry that wealth from generation to generation without losing any of it. So there's a kind of an inherent conservatism to what he thinks about. And it wouldn't look inherently sort of conservatively whacked out to anyone from another era. But to the current era, he just looks like an old stodgy bastard to some. And it's going to be a classic case where the old guys are going to say, yeah, I've seen this plot before. I know how it ends.
Well, then I have to ask, Dave, is 2019 the year that valuations matter again?
I don't know.
I don't know.
You know that's true, too. I actually read an article by Larry Summers, right? Boy, I'm bottom feeding now.
Yeah.
And he basically does some Bayesian analysis where he says where he shows that the probability of a recession sort of changes over time and it gets higher and higher, but then it plateaus, and so that some number of years out, it just each year has a certain coin tossing quality to it, and the argument he makes is therefore, it doesn't matter how old the expansion is. The probability now is becoming a constant with a lot of noise, of course. But I got to think that's wrong. Now, it might be based on empirical observation. I don't know. But the longer an expansion goes, the more scar tissue you develop and the more damage you develop from the expansion. And, you know, expansions are great, but then they start doing bad stuff, right? And you start overexpanding. And so I think expansions do die of old age. So I don't believe Summers' model. And it might be like someone who's, 80 years old, you say the chance of them dying at 81 or 82 or 83 is about the same. But they are closer to death than a 20-year-old.
Yeah. Bless you for reading Summers. I don't subject myself to that very often. In fact, not this year at all, I don't think. So good on you for doing that. But this is the longest expansion, so-called, second longest in history. And lots of recession signs sort of starting to creep up. So let me ask you this. How's the economy doing?
I think it's stunk for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I now think it's starting to show signs of failure. And so for a brief period this year, all of a sudden, I was giving this Goldilocks, high fives. And I'm thinking, how can this possibly be? A year ago, I was writing about this stuff, and there was already cracks in a number of regions of the economy, like housing and auto and things like that. And so I actually asked rhetorically, did I miss a boom? Did I blink or something? And in some sense, the answer is yes, because what we had this year were these one-off expenses, and they start with the hurricane rebuild from the 17 hurricane season, and they're still rebuilding. That shows up as GDP. That doesn't show up as wealth, but it shows up as GDP. And then you had the tax reductions. All of a sudden, there was this sort of, roid rage euphoria as people said, oh, fantastic, more money's coming from overseas. Turns out that money was always in some bank. That money was in banks like HSBC and Bank of America and stuff like that. So it's not like bringing it over here is any sort of construct that's worth even thinking about. It's in the multinational banking system. And then the third one was the tariff war, which people say, oh, no, that's bad for the economy, but not early on when people started front-running it and they started doing stuff very quickly to beat the tariffs. And so they were doing all sorts of exporting and importing and all the moves you make because you say it's going to get harder once those tariffs are in place. So we got this bolus of pre-tariff activity, which I sort of bizarrely called terrifying. So I think we did get a boost. I think we, you know, jammed some adrenaline in the corpse and it flinched.
Yeah, well, you know, as I drove around, I think you noted this as well. You know, I saw help wanted signs here and there. They seem to have had an uptick, but you know, the usual statistics that people were citing, like initial claims, I kept beating the drum on this, but it was too complex to really get much traction with. And the number of people who qualify to file initial claims has plummeted to an all-time low. Like, they're exhausted. To really qualify for an initial claim, you have to have held a full-time job that qualified you in some fashion. So all the people who are out there on part-time, you know, sub 30-hour weeks so they don't trigger any sort of healthcare benefits or whatever they're up to, it's just fewer people qualify. So that number was just one of many in this series of U.S. government, Soviet crop report equivalent reporting that doesn't tell us much. How do we, you know, signal from noise? What where do you see the balance of that in terms of indicating where we are in this economic cycle?
Well, so, you know, yeah, I absolutely have spotted the help wanted signs, but don't forget, these are the lowest rung on the economic ladder. And if someone's listening to this and they're in one of those jobs, no offense, but these are the jobs that require no skill to speak of. It requires certain personal skills, maybe. But, you know, when you see help wanted in front of McDonald's, this is not the same as if, you know, Caterpillar is now hiring 2,000 people. And if right now those are missing, I think. I watch for those, and I don't see factories being built. I don't see any of the stuff that's part of a real economy. What I see is the consumption economy, and we both know you don't get rich by consuming, right? The whole idea that we're a consumption economy is completely insanity. That's some guy who should be fired. There's no such thing as a consumption economy. You have an economy where you make stuff, and then you get to consume after you've made some wealth. And the consumption is reaping the profits of the wealth creation. It isn't the wealth creation per se.
And this is right at the heart of what I think what has bothered me the most as a skeptic. And I'm skeptical of this idea that wealth is in any way created by the Federal Reserve. They are a distributive or a redistributive organization. They take from one and give to the other. So they don't just create purchasing power out of nothing, but they have handed a lot of purchasing power to the 1%. So the question is, well, where'd that come from? Right. And so I think at least part of that is contained a little bit in this one quote. So many great nuggets, but I pulled this one out of your economy section. Maybe broken markets section. Broken markets. And the quote here is, equities ran 300%+ off the lows while the GDP tracked the Great Depression, compounding at 2% a year. End quote. That to me sort of encapsulates a lot in this, which maybe sums up in this statement. This time is different. The Fed's created real wealth. It's enduring. It's going to last. Equities are up 300%. We don't need that stinking economy. We've got price support by the central banks. They got our backs. Is that a fair way to characterize this, or am I missing something?
Yeah. Well, the other one, the metaphor that I loved, it's so deeply buried, right? I have an acquaintance who read one of my hearing reviews twice on an iPhone. There's a psychosis under that, right? The metaphor that I really liked that just kind of flipped out there and would easily go missed was that the Fed had made stone soup.
Yeah,
and so they brought out the pot and they threw a stone and they said, you know, if you guys could throw, you private equity, private enterprise guys could throw a few things in here, this would taste better, right? And so that's all the Feds do, is they bring out the kettle and the stone, and they hope the free market will actually bring the rest. I you can't print the prosperity. I think roughly speaking, the equities have to follow the GDP. I get a little tangled up in that detail sometimes, where I say, okay, but let's say GDP didn't grow. You in theory are still producing wealth every year. So I get, you and I as sort of resource consumption guys realize that, you know, you can't keep growing the GDP indefinitely because we'll swallow the earth, right? It'll be the stadium with the puddle in the middle of the stadium. Eventually, it exponentially blows up. So I've never, even all the way back to high school, understood the idea that the only way the economy can be healthy is to just keep growing. Then you fill the known universe with elephants if you do that. So
absolutely. Yeah, and there's this other idea, which I think you did a great job unpacking in this year in review, which is this trollop that, equities grow at 10% a year? Well, equities are a claim on something. So if you have both equities and debt both compounding at twice the rate that your underlying economy is compounding, even if you had infinite resources, eventually you have a math problem. But once you understand resources are limiting, there's a Liebig minimum somewhere in that story, right? Even, you know, once you find that limit in there, it's absolutely grade school math to prove that you can't have equities and debts compounding faster than your economy forever. It's just not hard. But oh my gosh, that might be one of the hardest concepts to try and get across to people, which means I don't think we're talking logic. I think we're talking belief systems. That's something I think you expose well, is how many belief systems are just easily scratched at.
Last year, I banged on back of the envelope calculations in which I tried to figure out why equities don't return the same as bonds. And you say, well, you know, of course they don't. Everyone knows that. But I go, why not? Why wouldn't the free market arbitrage those? Why wouldn't? Mm-hmm. And then I came to the conclusion it must be, and therefore long term they must return the same as bonds. And actually, you know, Ben Graham said that, but I think he didn't live in this era. But then what happened is after I wrote that last year, then all year long I thought about that, and it was sort of one of these, or the name for it, Baden-Meyerhoff syndrome, where you start noticing things that you wouldn't have otherwise noticed. And what you notice is there's a lot of people out there saying that equities don't return squat over time. And so, for example, this guy Rob Arnault, who was said by Howard Marks to be one of the true geniuses, right? And I know Howard Marks is good. And so, and Arnault says equities are going to return, when you correct for everything, about 3-3.5% a year over a long period. And there's no one who realizes that. And no one corrects for things like fees, and corrects for things like taxes, and corrects for things like when you have an inflated gain, not a real gain, but an inflated gain, then you get taxed on that, so you actually lose. I talked about it last year, but I spent more time trying to get a little bit deeper, and I pulled out this Macquarie paper, which I actually got sent to me by Jesse Felder, and he said, in case you missed this, which I had, of course, and it was this paper talking about, look, over time, you can get this. And I think his estimate was too high, but he said, but over, you know, 40-year periods, you can get killed. Now, there's a chart in there. If people are listening to this, they go read it. There's a chart in there that I think is the scariest chart of them all, and it's a plot of the inflation-adjusted S&P or Dow, I can't remember. And what I do is, everyone always says, how long did it take inflation adjusted to go from the peak where you don't want to be invested through the trough and then get your money back? That's the favorite trick, and it's usually about 20 years. But what people don't notice, what this chart shows so clearly, is that after you get your money back 20 years later on the capital gains, you go through a rise. Every time you go through this rise, which now you're in the black, and then it dips back in the final dip, the point where you go back right back to where the original peak was before you finally exit that awful sort of eddy that you're stuck in, turns out to be between 40 and 70 years later. So you literally can go 40 to 70 years on an inflation-adjusted capital gain of zero. It happened four times in the 20th century, from four major peaks to 40 to 70 years later, hitting that same price again on a dip before it finally took off and hopefully doesn't go back. This is the most terrifying chart that I couldn't get guys like Leibowitz actually created for me. So I said, screw this. So I used ChemDraw to create the thing. There's real sophisticated thinking for you. ChemDraw to make finance charts. And I made it myself. I said, this is what I'm trying to get you to make. And it's a scary chart to me. And so the other thing is, I always talk about, if you're investing throughout this, you know, if you buy in at 29 and you keep investing, you're still fine. I go, yeah. But if in 1929 you were 40 years into your investing career, you got no compounding left. You got no price cost averaging left in you. So a millennial who starts buying now, they'll be fine, because they'll buy all the way down and then all the way up, and they'll be fine. The boomer who's got 85 or 90% of their savings committed to the risk assets right now will never recover.
Well, indeed, in that 3 to 3.5% return, I might decompose that into 1% population growth and 2% productivity.
Oh,
there you go.
Population growth. Yeah, that's a biggie. The other thing is his 3.1 to 3.5% does not include changes in valuation. Mm-hmm. So he says throughout an entire market cycle, like Hussman likes to do, you get 3 to 3.5%. Assuming no change in valuation, whether you want to go from high to high or low to low, doesn't matter. Now, what he also said was that if you now factor in the valuation change that he thinks would get us to the mean value, the next 10 years is going to compound at minus 3%. And that will kill people, right? That's going to be demolishing. And Felder concludes that, and Hussman is even worse, and Jeremy Grantham says that. So these are not nitwits. These are smart guys. Now, other people just don't even pay attention.
So, you know, Hussman is the guy that really does it for me most because, I mean, he just takes the data, just runs the math, just has these incredible correlation charts between returns and valuations, where the only way to escape that negative return over the next 10 years, according to Hussman, is for something to be profoundly different this time. Something has to have changed, right?
And not gonna either.
What's that?
It's not gonna.
No, it's not going to.
For 200 years, it hasn't happened, so I don't know why it's going to happen now.
Well, you know, I guess the only thing we could hope for is that behind the scenes, the Federal Reserve and the other banks are going to just continue to prop things up forever. Hey, Hosanna, never shall we have trouble. But
see, that's the key, though. So we're at a super high valuation. If they just prop it up, then we go back to Rob Arnault's 3 to 3.5%, assuming no change in valuation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the predicted 3 to 3.5%. Now, here's the problem. Then you start getting cascading failures because pension funds assume 7 to 8. And so they're going to be coming in light. What do they have to do? They have to take corporate profits and dump them into the pension funds to bring them up to speed. And all of a sudden, corporate profits drop. And guess what? You're now going to get crushed.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just no way out of this. You know, we perceive we've created twice as much wealth as we've actually created. How do you get out of that? That's a delusion that will only be resolved by an awakening.
Well, it's true. And I've got 6 different directions I want to go with this. So let me first, let's take the core of the delusion to finish that out, and then I'll get to corporations. So debt. Debt is the thing that the Fed and the federal government would tell us can be safely ignored. Hey, deficits don't matter. Dick Cheney quote, you know, the Fed never factors in debt growth when it's saying, hey, look how great things are. So there's been a debt supercycle, Dave, in place since the early 1980s. Now, that broke in 2008. The U.S. Federal Reserve said not on our watch. And now there's another $100 trillion just of debt with which to contend on the global balance sheets. Dave, take us through the role of debt and, you know, I don't know, in everything that we see and hear and touch and taste today.
Well, you know, debt and lack of savings are two sides of the same coin. And so, you know, the boomers have plenty of debt. At a personal level, the boomers have plenty of debt and they have no savings. So if they had a ton of savings and a ton of debt, I said, well, at least you can cancel those two, but they don't.
Right.
The millennials have saved nothing, right? The younger generation, and they seem to not know it. So the great survey showing that they have something like, you know, the average 30 to 35 year old has something like $15,000 and thinks they're retiring at 56. I'm going, you guys, I thought we did a lot of drugs when I was young, right? This is crazy. And the boomers are so toast and they're out of time, right? The clock is ticked. The clock is, you know, it's a countdown clock like I'm Lost. And I don't see mathematical ways out. The debt, you know, the pension funds are basically just leverage. So they're basically debt. Society owes these pensions. They could stiff the people, of course. But you know, when a state is funded to the tune of, you know, 20%, no way to grow out of it. And someone's got to either write a check or tell these people that they're not going to get paid. And we're certainly seeing some of the latter. Mm-hmm. But that's huge debt. And then you got the sovereign debt, which gets a little vague because you say, well, I don't even know. They print the crap. So how do you know what the consequence? I have trouble with the consequences of the Fed's balance sheet.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Minard who said that, you know, they could have gotten 19-fold inflation and they didn't. And I said, yet. But you and I both, I think, were predicting massive inflation. It hasn't shown up yet, but it also could be one of these time bombs, right?
Well, inflation always shows up where the money flows, and so the Fed printed, but they didn't print and hand it to the government directly. They printed it to the financial market. So what did we see? We saw Gulfstream 5s, luxury yachts, trophy properties, gems, art, wines, collectibles that the rich are interested in. Those went through massive inflation, as did financial assets, which the Fed considers those wealth, not a form of inflation. So I have a disagreement around that. So yep. I think we did. I would argue we did see inflation. It just didn't go to the places you expected it, like milk.
So, yeah, you know, I thought the Bernanke savings club model was stupid.
Yeah,
I thought it was totally irrational. And actually, William White of the BIS also said it was nuts. But I actually, one of the books I read this year was by Mervyn King. And he brought it down to such simple terms, I said, oh, I get it. I now know what he's saying. What Mervyn points out is the savings club model is that what we did is we sent dollars overseas buying, you know, with a big trade imbalance and buying Chinese goods, buying oil, buying all these things that should have come back in the form of an inflationary pressure on our goods, right? So it should have come back in the form of, you know, buying up stuff from us. And what it did is it came back in the form of investment money. And so it bid treasuries up, which sent interest rates low, and it bid stocks up, which sent them to the nosebleed valuation section. And so the savings club, meaning the investment targeting of those overseas funds, instead of coming back causing goods inflation, caused asset inflation. And so in that sense, the model made sense to me. And it was really Mervyn King who sort of brought it to clarity. And he says, what you end up with is asset inflation and a lousy economy. And I'm going, and that's what we have. So I guess that model's pretty good, right? It's pretty, it makes sense. So we get these huge asset gains and not a lot of economic activity except at Burger King.
And for those listening, Mervyn King, ex-governor of the Bank of England, and one of the people who had a memoir that came out a few years after the financial crisis, who said, oh my gosh, people, we were hours away from full-blown systemic crisis. Very scary. We had to do some crazy things. Do you think, Dave, that that's still what's driving the central banks at this point, is some lurking nihilistic fear of a systemic crisis that would get out of their control?
I have two fears.
All right.
My first fear is that, and that they're looking going, holy cow, we can't have a recession. Now, if the Fed reaches a point where it says we can't have a recession, we're in trouble, because the Feds of the past were always the root cause of the recession, and they knew it. And so if the Fed's all of a sudden saying, we no longer can even step on the economy to solve our inflation problems, then we got a big problem. My bigger fear is that they don't know this. They're actually that clueless.
Yeah.
So, you know, whatever. I get in trouble every time I pick on the Fed. There's always some Fed lover who wants to smack me around for a while, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that you and I are going to have that Schadenfreude victory romp because they've been absolutely clueless, and not least of which is they're unaware of the fact that the earth has limits, and they're very busy peddling to create the exponential debt model in perpetuity. Hey, Hosanna. It's just dumb. It's just absolutely ridiculously dumb. We need people who have systems thinking, and we've got people who are Taylor rule junkies. It's just not working out over there at the Fed, but we'll see. We'll get back to that in a year or two. So, hey, I need to get back to corporations because can we discuss corporate buybacks, please? Look, okay, Dave, first, I have a really bad habit, which is I get in these really useless, stupid Twitter arguments with people. And I know I shouldn't. It's almost like a compulsion at this point. But recently, having gotten in an argument with people who are claiming that corporations are doing great, they've had all these great productivity improvements, and that, in fact, they funded stock buybacks entirely out of free cash flow. I'm like, what are you, nuts? Did you not notice the $5 trillion of new debt they poured on, which matches the buybacks? Help us understand the role of share buybacks here, please, and getting to where we are and what it might mean for the future.
Have you talked to Adam within 24 hours? Because I actually sent him an email last night on this because I had arithmetic epiphany.
Ooh,
I do an analysis on a simple company, and I concluded that if a company has cash in the books and they take the cash and they do a corporate buyback and that the market is liquid enough that the buyback doesn't influence the price, that the shares should move precisely zero, 0.0. The shares should not move.
Right.
And I look at this, I go, how is that possible, right? And it turns out it falls right out of the arithmetic. And then I said, okay, let's assume that they do push the price of the shares up. And what I end up concluding is the per share ownership of productive assets by the share buyback that pushes the share price up actually drop. So the investors who are sitting on the shares while the company's buying back shares is actually losing. They own a smaller fraction of the company on a per share basis. So the value of their shares is going down. And meanwhile, the price of their shares are going up because the bid is driving them up. And I realized that while they're doing share backs to push the bid up, they're actually depleting the net worth in reality of the investors who are sitting on those shares. And that hit me last night. And so I sent something to Adam and he sent something back. And I called my brother and I called a friend at Goldman or ex-Goldman. And I sent it to him. I said, look at this. Tell me what I'm missing. And he said he couldn't see a hole in this. So I'm going to get Adam to send me a rough draft of part one before you upload it because I want to wedge in a little bit more. A little bit more. I'd actually missed this. I actually had drawn the wrong arithmetic conclusion about what a share back should do to prices. And of course, then the share buyback, to the extent that when you drive up the shares by putting a bid under them, there's no mathematical way to predict how much they should go up because it depends on the nonlinearity of the whole liquidity thing. And so you know, an example I said was that Kodak one time jumped $4 on the last 200 share trade of the day, right? That's how little you can push a share up with. And so when a company is putting a constant bid under its shares, what it's doing is forcing the valuations to the roof. And meanwhile, it turns out it's hurting the investors to the extent that although the shares are soaring, the per share ownership of productive assets is dropping. And that's the part I didn't get.
I don't get that. Why is the per share ownership? Because if there's a million shares outstanding, half go away, I still own one of those 500,000 shares. Doesn't my percentage allocation go up?
Let me see if I can do it verbally. So you have 900 million of what we'll call the value of the company and 100 million of what we'll say is assets, you know, something where they store their money.
Mm-hmm.
If they take the 100 million and they buy back shares and it doesn't move the share price, they will drive the share count from let's say the share 100 million shares, so it's $10 a share. Mm-hmm. What they'll do is they'll take 10 million shares off the market, but their balance sheet will be $10 million light. And it turns out the arithmetic says now 90 million shares owns a $900 million company and no cash. And as a consequence, the value that those shareholders has is still $10 a share to the penny.
Yep.
Now what you do is you say, and I don't know if that made sense, but I'm going to lay it out. Now you say, well, what happens if they drive up the price of the shares? So what happens is they take their $100 million in cash, then they start buying shares, but because they're driving up the price, $100 million doesn't buy you 10 million shares at $10 a piece because the price is going up. So you buy less than 10 million.
Gotcha.
So now
I follow
you have a
that.
Balance sheet that has $900 million worth of company, but has over 90 million shares, which means the value of the shares is now less than $10 because they bought froth.
Right. I gotcha. And the only
and
that's way that, yeah,
it's so simple. And then I started asking, well, what if they leave the shares on the books? Now they're not supposed to. They're supposed to be extinguishing them.
Mm-hmm.
And it just doesn't get any better.
Well, let's be clear. I mean, GE bought a bunch of shares back, and
yeah,
how did that work
well.
Out?
An Oracle? Oracle? Holy GE, in case your listeners don't know this, GE is so insolvent GE is a zombie of a higher order. And I think Powell is staring at GE going, oh my God, what happens if GE goes? They got $170 billion worth of debt. That's what we call AIG, right? That's huge. And you got Deutsche Bank, which is huger, and they're doing laps around the drain. So yeah, there's some big beasts out there waiting to exact revenge on these non-free marketeers. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, to make this very temporal and to sort of date this interview, we're doing this on December 19th, which is the Fed day. They've just announced their rate hike decision. They are going to hike. Maybe they're only going to do two next year, not three. Wasn't quite dovish enough. The S&P was up 38 at one point today. Now it's down minus 21. So the market is not happy with anything other than complete abdication by the Fed. Looks like we're not happy with a put. I think the Powell Fed is different from the Yellen Fed, who I hated, and the Bernanke Fed, who I loathed, right? But Powell is not blinking at these markets. So as they go down that, this corporate share buyback is the highest level of it happened just in this last quarter, finishing up in the third quarter of 2018, highest ever. I think that's going to go down as stupidest ever. Would you agree?
Oh, totally. Here's the question, though, is so if you plot share buybacks superimposed upon the S&P, they correlate. It's one of the best looking correlations you'll find out there. Mm-hmm. And the question is, are the share buybacks causing it, or is it just that it's dumb money and they don't buy at the bottom and they buy at the top? I don't know. It's conceivable that there's so much leverage share buyback activity now that it has to correlate. I don't know if it's that big or not. Do you have any feel for whether the bid under the shares is big enough to you know? And then when they repatriated all the taxes, apparently you can't buy back shares overseas or it's a tax event. So they had to repatriate them to then buy. Here's a dangerous analysis. Everyone's looking at all the corporate debt, but a lot of it was accrued because they wanted to buy back shares, but they couldn't yet repatriate their profits. And so they were looking at the profits overseas and going, okay, we got tons of money. We'll just borrow money in the U.S. and buy back shares, and we'll leave that money over there. And then it became this, oh, make America great. Let's repatriate all the profits. And then they pretend like they're going to build plants, right? Like they didn't have enough capital to build plants already. Right? Yeah. They're not going to build plants. We knew they were going to use it to financially engineer.
Yeah.
So the money comes back, and they just basically extinguished that and bought more shares and played more games.
Yeah, there was no capital shortage. So that was not one of the reasons they were not building property, plant, and equipment or investing in their human assets. So,
right.
Yeah. All right. I have to switch some gears here because I just have to know a couple of things. First, Dave, you wrote this, quote, Aristotle noted that an educated man can entertain an idea without endorsing it. I also have a penchant for entertaining any idea until it dies of SIDS or gets legs, and I have to chase it down. I am, in short, a conspiracy theorist. We should all be conspiracy theorists because men and women of wealth and power conspire, end quote. So, Dave, I feel that in the U.S., this conversation needs to be had over and over again to undo, let's call it, some very careful programming. Conspiracies happen, and they happen as the rule, not the exception, is my view. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's my view. So many things move from the so-called conspiracy theory column to the conspiracy fact column. Which ones kind of stand out for you? And let's have this conversation about conspiracy theories, because I get charged with that all the time. And I feel like I'm just applying brain dead logic in most cases.
So, conspiracy theory is just saying, look, I have this theory that they're conspiring. Right? That doesn't seem that inflammatory to me. But then the question is what? You know, if they're conspiring to hide the moon landing, I don't think, right? Area 51, I don't think.
Yep.
So there's various probabilities on truth. I don't see how you can possibly look at, for example, like geopolitics and not realize that the conspiracies are just gargantuan and pervasive and everywhere. And one of the problems I had this year, by the way, one of my readers said this year took a toll on you. And she wasn't saying it was a lot of work. She was saying I could see it in your writing. It was taking a toll on you emotionally. the thing that was killing me is I spent so much time trying to understand Trump and collusion and the FBI, and it's so disgustingly dirty and filthy and corrupt, and the connectivity say, oh my God, you wait a minute, that guy used the lawyer for Fusion GPS also? You know, there were just so many connections that you go, that's just not right. And I couldn't write about it. So the people who think I'm going to explain the collusion stuff are going to be sorely disappointed. Last year I tried. I just gave up. I just looked and said, I've got 100 pages of notes, and it's just sitting there. I didn't do anything with it. I took on the Kavanaugh hearings. I took on the nerve gas poison. I took on a bunch of stuff. But I really felt like I left stuff on the cutting room floor this year. So that would took a toll on me. But also, it's so dark that there's a sense of futility, right? And so there's this sense that we're looking at Roman senators doing bad stuff, and there's just no control. And they're so – the Kavanaugh hearings, to me, which I do go into, and I'm going to really irritate some people on those, but it's just the politics are so thick and so corrupt it's dark. So I'm going to have joy when this thing starts collapsing. I'm actually going to be laughing my way to the bottom because I've been waiting for someone to pull back the curtain on this mess. Right.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And when it comes to the rule of law, I think, King Alfred, who first started to implementing rule of law in 989 in England, understood that the appearance and the fact of law is important, and the appearance just got shredded, so shredded. What Comey did and did not do is just absolutely mind-boggling, but maybe something on safer territory to move out. One of the things I've noticed in lots of markets that price discovery is no longer a real thing. And that we see price manipulative moves where somebody, air quotes, just dumps tons and tons of things. It could be oil, could be this and that, but silver, because I own some, because I care. If you're a silver producer or a miner, you should care. We should all care that prices are not manipulated. And it was just so patently obvious that prices were manipulated. Well, a JP Morgan trader is now been convicted and facing sentencing on that, and just radio silence across the news about this. But silver has been completely manipulated. And for years, I was like, look at this manipulation. People are like, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. I'm like, no, just look at the tape. Look at that. 2:30 in the morning is no time to suddenly put 6,000 contracts up at market, right? That's just
not... And 264,000 into gold in the middle of the night one day. But the silver one you're talking about, there was this, I think it was like a 24 days in a row that it not only went down, but you could put a straight edge down it.
Yeah, 45 degrees.
It was just this linear decay as though someone said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to knock 2% a day off for the next 24 days, right? And no one cares. And then you mentioned the JP Morgan trader got convicted, and he said it was pervasive. He said it wasn't just me. This is happening everywhere, and no one cares about that. And so at this point, the problem is that if the markets were fair valued, this wouldn't matter, because they'd be manipulating it around prices. But because the market, I can't buy equities now. I just can't buy them because the prices are so wretched. And when they manipulate them up to out of the buy zone, then it means I got to stay on the sideline. And so that's what irritates me.
Absolutely.
I want to buy bargains.
Well, absolutely. And
husband said I was, what was the phrase he used? Grizzly. I said ghoulish.
Well, myself as well, and I get tagged as being a perma bear, but nothing could actually be further from the truth. I wish I had things I could believe in, that I could value, that I could put some diligence into and understand. And every time I scratch at these things and I put a little bit of valuation effort into them, I go, this is disgusting. I can't buy this. This is absolutely ridiculous.
Well, it's also true, though, and this is really important. And again, there's a great Hussman analysis on this, and that is, and everyone knows, if PEs, let's use PE as a metaphor since it's a worthless stat otherwise, metaphorically, when PEs get down to super low values, half of the companies will have even lower PEs. And so, yep. When the PEs were 7 back in 1981, I think it was, half the companies had PEs below 7. And so if you somehow think, you say, oh, I'll buy a stock that has a PE of 14 and I'll be safe, you go, yeah, what happens when it goes to 5 Or what happened when it soars because their earnings go to hell, right? I mean, you're not protected. So value won't be protected. The way value is protected is if on an absolute scale, it's cheap. It can't be a relative scale. You can't say, oh, yeah, because the whole – and people say, what about the emerging markets? They say, okay, tell me. If the U.S. does a 50% or more correction, some say as high as 70, I can get to 80.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen to emerging markets? You going to do well there? And the answer is no, right? No. People will sell anything they can to solve the problem. Everything will sell off. Right? That's like saying, oh, what if only the bow of the Titanic sinks, right? And it's like, man, that's not how it works.
Well, the front fell off.
Yeah, the front fell off, but the guys in the back are drinking mint juleps, right? And so there is no – once the market gets frothy, all 10 deciles correct violently.
Well, maybe that's happening even as we're speaking. You know, I said the S&P was up 38. It's now down 55, just crashed through the 2,500 mark. So a round number provided literally zero stopping power. It's now at 2,491 and falling. So maybe it started. So back to what we were talking about, though, Dave, you mentioned this magic word to me, the screeples. The screeples, for those listening, were the father and daughter pair in the UK that were poisoned with this Novichok class that could only be produced in Russia, poisoned. And I wrote extensively about that at the time. Nothing added up, not the method of poisoning, not the type, not how long it persists, not the crazy case of that of the police detective, Nick Bailey, who somehow got it and never was, you know, to be talked about again, on and on and on. After all that, nothing adds up. Now the whole mainstream apparatus is bought into the idea, as heavily promoted by MI6 and the UK government under Theresa May, that, hey, it was a couple of super inept Russian agents that did it. Dave, tell us about your views and that test question you posed to some of your students. I love that story. I tell it to people over dinner. I don't get invited back, but I love the story.
So to make a long story short, the Skripal story broke out. And if, as an organic chemist, I can promise you that the Novichok nerve agents are stupidly simple molecules. They are so simple to make that I think there's four ingredients. For every one of them has just four ingredients. And I think you could literally take the bottles of each of the four ingredients straight out of your, you know, chemical supply house shelving, pour them together into a bucket, and you would have a toxic, toxic brew. Mm. It's that easy, right? It's like telling Martha Stewart, go make chocolate chip cookies. And so what happened was the Theresa May crowd came out and says, so the Skripals, they find them in a coma. The evidence that they were poisoned stinks. But let's say they were poisoned by a Novichok, and then they say, well, it's Russian technology. It's military grade. And I go, what's military grade? It's like unlike the Walmart diluted form. What are we talking about here? And so I came out and I said, I'll keep it clean, but I said, you idiots who think you're geopolitical experts have got to understand that this technology is trivial. And anyone who says that it's got to be the Russians because it's Russian technology is lying to you. And it got ignored, largely ignored. And then I did another tweet as the saber rattling started. I said, I'm just going to say this one more time. Whoever's telling you that this had to be the Russians because it's Russian technology is a liar, unquestionably a liar. Now, they may have other evidence of why the Russians did it, but it's not Russian technology. Every country in the world has chemists who are easily good enough to make the Novichoks. Every country, including the ones that you would never visit. And yep. And so they kept saying that, but only the Russians know how to make them. And I go, no. And so what happened is the second tweet got legs. And the next thing, I found myself doing all these talk shows and going on Russia Today. They liked it, of course. And, you know, on George Galloway's show and Fault Lines and shows like that. And they would ask me, I said, this is stupid. This is simple stuff. And so if you want to claim that it's the Russians, that's fine, but not because they're complicated. I said, my grad students could do it. So the test you mentioned is on my final exam of my course in the spring. I told them the story, how I ended up in the middle of this international incident. And that, and I drew him a picture of one of the Novichoks and said, my assertion is that anyone can make this. And I said, design a synthesis of this. It's a lecture course, not a lab. Mm-hmm. And everyone but one kid got full credit. Now, as I said in the second part of this year in review thing, which you haven't seen yet, as I said, he wouldn't make a very good terrorist, apparently, right? And so one kid lost points. But they all, because the design is pouring water out of a boot. And so their arguments kept coming back to only the Russians know how to make it. And then there was these silly, like they interviewed this Ruski who was talking out of both sides of his face. And they said something about, well, it had to be the Russians because only they know the structures. And then the interviewer says, but you published them in a book. And he says, well, I don't know if they saw my book. I'm going, and it was an $8 book. I said, maybe only the Russians can afford it. So the Skripal story is a lie, head to toe a lie. And the other area I go into is Khashoggi. You know, I believe he got sliced and diced and fed to the camels. I don't doubt that.
Right.
But I'm watching the media chew on Khashoggi and completely ignoring we got 12 million Yemenis starving to death.
Right.
And I'm going, I don't care about Khashoggi. I call him one dead Khashoggi, ODK. We got 12 million Yemenis. I said, I don't care about Khashoggi. In that region of the world, that's not even a blip.
Absolutely. And so
I've had people say, oh, my God, you know, you're the only one who thinks that. And I'm going, there's women who get raped who then get stoned to death for the audacity of getting raped in that country. And you're worried about Khashoggi? That's nuts. You're psychopathically misguided. And so I bang on Khashoggi hard and say, you know why you're worried about Khashoggi? Because the media's telling you to be worried about Khashoggi, because someone's telling them to tell you to be worried about Khashoggi, and there's a conspiracy for you. And then, there was, I'm free associating here now. There was Mike Krieger, I think it was, saw a Fox News poll that said, you know, on the chlorine gas attacks, which again I ended up in the middle of, mm-hmm. said that should we go to war with Syria over these? And there was 50,000 votes in, and it was 2-1 no. And then 2 hours later, there's another 140,000 votes, and it's now 2-1 yes. And I'm going, oh, yeah, I believe that poll.
Yeah, that's a good poll.
Hillary must have run that poll. So it's a nuts world.
It is a nuts world. And just on the Khashoggi thing, you know, all of a sudden you saw Trump trying to soft pedal the whole thing, and then the CIA comes out and says, oh, no, we have the recordings of this, you know, magic. And so this all goes back and forth for a bit, and I heard Bernie Sanders come out. It was on NPR, and he really waxed eloquent about what a grave tragedy this Khashoggi thing was and how the civilized world can't stand for that. Meanwhile, he's dead radio silent on all kinds of other stuff, you know, and it's
Benghazi.
Just across the board, you know.
Benghazi, right?
Right.
Dead silent on Benghazi, but dead silent on how many people the Clintons have whacked in their career, right? Jesus. Now, one dead Khashoggi, that's all it is. It's a dead guy. It's a dead guy in a region of the world where bodies can be bought from .com companies online, right? It's just a dead guy.
Well, and just, I mean, it happened in Turkey, and I don't know how many journalists in Turkey have gone up dead in very, very mysterious or even overtly, obviously assassinated circumstances, but it's many dozens. And
so what it means, therefore, is that it's not about Khashoggi.
Right.
It has nothing. Khashoggi's a stalking horse. Khashoggi is just the vehicle by which they're saying we want to achieve something. And I haven't been able to figure out what that is.
Me
I would
either.
Say it would be bomb. So here's my view on the Middle East. This is one of my big epiphanies. And that is the Middle East. We're always talking about the Middle East being about oil. I don't think it's about oil. It's about war. The war industry is a trillion-plus industry. And when the wall came down and we couldn't build missiles and bombs and all the stuff to keep the Cold War running hot, then we had to find a new enemy. Lo and behold, boom, terrorists appear out of the Middle East. The next thing we know, we're spending – what do we spend in Iraq? $6 trillion. That's $2 trillion went into the coffers of Boeing and Northrop Grumman and places like and Halliburton and places like that. So the war industry is making a fortune off the Middle East, and so our foreign policy is easily it's horrifyingly ununderstandable unless you say the purpose is to keep them fighting, and then you say, oh, now it makes sense.
Well, absolutely. And of course, that's my stalking horse for why Russia suddenly became a big bad boogeyman. It's not because
exactly
they did anything particularly you could point to and say, there, that was unacceptable. Oh my gosh, they had the people of Crimea vote, and people overwhelmingly voted to rejoin the country they used to belong to in 54? That's insane. We can't have that. So it was called an annexation. But, you know, and of course, the irony for people like you and I, and hopefully the people listening, is that in Crimea, they actually have a more secure voting system than in the United States, where we come up with statistically impossible or so deeply improbable, I can use the word impossible, results on elections time and time again, and neither party says boo about it. And that's how you know the fix is in. As far as I'm concerned.
So the parties, the reason they don't say boo is because to them, that's all part of the game. So they're playing capture the flag with the voting. And if you learn anything from the 2016 election, is that everything is rigged.
Right.
And then if you learn one more message is, and they still somehow blew it.
Yeah.
But everything is rigged. You watch the primaries and you know, it just everything was rigged. Bernie wasn't going to win. They thought Trump wasn't going to win. They completely misunderstood his risk. And they misjudged him, and they faked the polls, and then they believed the results of the polls. I'm going, it's like you pulled a rabbit out of a hat that you put in there and you're surprised. Right. And that's what's crazy about it. And so I think they thought they had it in the bag and everything was going to be nice and quiet. And after Hillary got elected, then Comey would go away quietly and they wouldn't have to call out Mueller and any of that stuff. Then Trump won. And all of a sudden the deep state guys were in a total panic. And you've got I don't know who watches this stuff, but you've got guys like the former head of the CIA out on Twitter saying to Trump, we are going to destroy you. And then he has a fit. When Trump takes away his security clearance, I'm going, Jesus, the guy would be in jail if I had my say, right? What kind of treasonous crap is that?
Plus he's lying to Congress. And,
lying to Congress. There's a real crime. Right? Everyone lies to Congress. They lie to each other.
Well, I just was reading today about the Flynn thing that people said, oh, you can't lie to the government. Everybody knows that. I'm like, well, Clapper did. Nothing happened there. I don't know.
I'm guessing Flynn is one of the only good guys in Congress. I haven't watched the Flynn thing closely. Just for some reason, things go off my radar and not to come back. I don't know why. But I'm going to guess that Flynn didn't do squat. I'm going to guess he got Martha Stewarted, right? He got hit on a technicality or something, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But such is the nature of it. And of course, you know, chronicling the thrashings of the empire as it you know, fails to notice its own self-inflicted wounds and ultimate demise is a lot of fun. You know, for me, the frustrating part, you know, where I age visibly and where people can notice the impact on my health is because there's so many predicaments that we have to do something about. This has been the year it's sort of broke into public awareness. 3 years I've been talking about the science behind the insects disappearing. And I'm this ecologist, you know, a training at heart that sort of believes wiping out the bottom of the food pyramid is a bad idea. You know, I hold that view.
Yeah, I can't imagine why you'd want to clean out the food chain from the bottom up.
That's me.
So
right?
The bees are going away.
Everything.
The rumors, Roundup's doing it to the bees. So it's like a DDT moment, except for we can actually live without the birds more than the bees, right? They seem to go together metaphorically.
Yeah, and it's everything. It's like by weight, you know, it's every insect class out there. We can't even clarify them all because somebody hasn't even studied why, you know, how many midges there used to be. There's just less of them, right? So, you know, it's not silent spring. This is the frustrating part. It's silent spring, summer, fall, and winter. I mean, it looks like the whole, like, we're doing like this vast wipeout. So it feels like we really need to be talking about that stuff. But, you know, to the extent we're distracted by the deep state doing really dumb stuff that, you know, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. So, you know, to me, that's the frustrating part is there are conversations we need to be having that we're not having that are really important. right?
And 20. They put glyphosate on fields and on a wholesale level now. It didn't used to do that. If you drive past a field, they put glyphosate on, it's this brown field. And I go, they didn't used to do that before.
Yeah.
The other thing I've noticed, and I don't know how this correlates, but anecdotally, I'm seeing a lot more big mammals than I ever used to see. And I don't know what that means, but we go in the Adirondacks and we're seeing way more deer and we're again seeing much more roadkill. And I think these things cycle around anyway. So I think that means something is I'm probably falling into the trap I just warned about. But I see that. The other thing I'm watching out of pure entertainment value are things like the Ring of Fire. Now, again, it could be the Ring of Fire is just acting like the Ring of Fire acts, but it certainly looks active to me. And you can measure the rise of the Yellowstone Caldera. It is rising. Mm-hmm. It's rising some like an inch a year. It's some ridiculously rapid rise. And you know, we can stop talking about global warming if the Yellowstone Caldera blows, because global warming is going to be the least of our concerns.
No, we'll be trying to activate global warming if that happens, because then we'll be in cooling.
Yeah, and the scientists want to drill into it and shoot water into it to cool it off. I'm going, oh, come on, guys, don't do that. Yeah,
no.
Think of it as a big zit. You don't drill into it.
No. No, that's not. No, let's not. Oh man. So, hey, we're coming up on the end of our time, but before we go there, so for as you look forward. We're the year in review, and everybody, we're talking with Dave Collum, and we're talking about the incredible year in review, which is now up at the Peak Prosperity site. Come check it out. Read it there. It'll be up on Zero Hedge. It'll syndicate. We'll get it out there. Everybody needs to read it. That's the year in review. Dave, as you look forward, what do you think we're looking at here for 2019?
Crazy politics. Mm-hmm. I think the markets have started correcting in earnest. So I think this time next year we'll be talking about the brutalization of investors and pension funds and stuff like that. And I'm laddering money in 2 and 3 year treasuries. And you say, well, what if it really drops? Aren't you locking it up? This thing won't correct. This monster bubble won't correct in some V-bounce thing. The patient investors will have plenty of time to pull a trigger on this thing. And I'm working on plans for how to recognize when it's at the right place and how to start, you know, investing in things that are rational and stuff like that. But how not to get caught like in 09, but that's how you get caught, right? Isaac Newton knew the tulip mania was nuts, and then he got or South Seas, I guess it was one of the two.
Yeah,
crazies.
he was the South Sea guy.
And he and then he said, "Oh, I was wrong." He bought into it and got crushed, right? So you know, and I'm pretty sure Isaac was smarter than me. and so I could be duped. I tried to get Hussman to capitulate and go long. I said, "John, until you or Felder goes long, this market's going to keep going up." And that's when he called me Grizzly. I can't remember what it was, but it was I said ghoulish. I think the markets are now looking like a sort of a precessing top, and they're starting to wobble. And a metastable system doesn't wobble for long. And so I think we'll start to give back, you know, 10 years of gains. My prediction based on sort of the long-term valuations, I think we got at least 50% correction in this. And again, I can get all the way to 80 if we go through the mean, which you have to do, right? You can't. It's not a lame wall be gone. You don't get to sit above the mean all the time. And the guys who were sitting in the Dow in 29 at 350, they just couldn't have imagined it would be 41 before it was done. They couldn't fathom it.
Yeah.
And people say, well, we can't have it go that low because look, the carnage. And I said, just because you need the returns doesn't mean you get them, right?
Absolutely.
The very fact that you need them means you probably won't get them. It is the very need, right? With all those promises that we can't fulfill globally. Yeah. So I think that. I think everything else may look fairly normal, although the other reason, here's the black swan model. So conspiracy theory time. Here's the big mm-hmm. theory. I think that if you believe in the idea of the deep state, which I do, I don't know if I've defined it well yet. But that idea, by the way, has been around for dozens of years. People think it's a new term. It's not. If they hate Trump, which I'm not sure is true, because they either got to win him over and control him or hate him. But if they haven't controlled Trump, which I see evidence they are, but they might want him out of there. And the fastest way to get him out of there is make sure we go into November of 2020 with blood, right? With blood in the streets economically, so that Trump can't stand up there and say, you know, the economy's huge and, you know, it's fantastic. So I think you want to leave Trump apologizing for destroying the economy if you want him to not be in the White House in 2021.
Well, that's certainly interesting. And of course, you mentioned crazy politics as one of your year forward things. And as we're speaking, I think it was just today, this morning, I read that the Yellow Vest movement took down the Prime Minister of Belgium over that crazy, apparently,
they
over the
did?
Yeah. He offered to resign. So go Yellow Vest. You know, those seem to me to be the direct result of so many years of unfair neoliberal, you know, so-called economics, which basically just shaft everybody to give it to a few multinationals in the top 0.1%, as well as what the central banks have done. Would you agree that maybe the people have finally woken up to the just how badly they've been screwed and decided that's it?
Well, so I write a lot about this too, even though I don't talk so much politics, but I talk about this. And at the end, by the way, just warning, I actually talk about religion.
Oh.
But I believe it will not be polarizing. I'm going to take the stance of an atheist, pro-choice, and endorse religion. it's a how do you lose or how do you win? I don't know which, but but I think when I think we're in an era now where everyone's mad. I think the beta test was Occupy Wall Street. Now you've got more virulent things like Antifa and stuff like that. But I blame Obama, not because I dislike the guy and not because I dislike his politics, but because he made one critical decision. That was to not prosecute anybody. And the populace needed to see some retribution. And they didn't get any. They mm-hmm. they got the reverse of it. So I think everyone's mad, and they know they're not rich, and they know they're in trouble, and they know they don't have any money, and they know they've got a big debt. And so they don't even need to fully understand why they're mad. All they have to do is be in the street one day when some guy lights up a car and they go, oh, I could do that.
Yeah.
And then they light up a car. And then next thing you know, you got the Battle of Portland going on. You got Paris burning. You got Belgium. I saw the Belgians were acting funky. I'm thinking, Belgium, those guys are like, what, are the Swiss going to start rioting now? What are we doing here, right?
Yep.
And so I think we're in a period where people are mad, and they're all mad in their own personal way, but they're all willing to get mad together. And Arab Spring, one Tunisian who lit himself on fire on the doorstep of some building. And next thing you know, you got regimes falling because the one flammable Tunisian triggered it.
Yeah,
and he didn't cause it. He triggered it.
The spark. It found a very, very thick tinder pile to land in. And
that's right. That's right. A little bit of gas and a match. That's all it took. And, you know, Rodney King almost, you know, those riots almost spread across the country. We nipped them in the bud, but we got away with one on that, right?
Yep.
And that could pick up here. It could pick up anywhere. And if you watch the police in these riots, they're so scared, right? These are a bunch of young kids, basically, right? These are not, you know, Navy SEALs. And these guys are standing there by the dozen, and they're terrified of these protesters because the cops can't start shooting. But at the same time, they could start getting shot. And then what happens, you know? So you don't want a Kent State moment.
Well,
but they got people.
It's all fun and games for the elites until the police figure out they're actually on the same side as the protesters. Meaning,
that's the other thing.
Yeah.
That's the other. These guys go home and they're mad. So, right. So all of a sudden the Praetorian Guard says, you know, this emperor's not doing for me what I want.
Wait, what happened to my pension?
Yeah, exactly. What happened to my pension? That's exactly right. And so when it's no longer perceived to be your advantage to play with the team, you switch teams.
Yeah.
And then you end up with bad stuff because revolutions never produce positive change, right? I mean, I guess the U.S. American Revolution did, but you know, it's a bloody mess. What's the quote that someone said? Wars are when the government tells you who's your enemy. Revolutions are when you figure it out for yourself.
Right. Or as JFK said, those who would make peaceful revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable.
Or in the movie The Debaters, where the guy at the end, he's debating this black kid who's debating Harvard kids on peaceful civil disobedience. And they had to take the side of favoring it. And the Harvard guy said, look, you know, you've got to follow the letter of the law. And this kid says, you better hope I can do peaceful civil disobedience because the alternative is terrible. And I'm going, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Right. And so to undo all of that, I guess what we'd have to see is many decades of neoliberal policies that began under Bill Clinton in the United States in earnest would have to be undone. And I know Obama was smooth and very polished, and he was an easy person to listen to. But he prosecuted zero Wall Street bankers and pushed water cannons against the Standing Rock protesters who were simply saying, hey, we would like to have some peaceful say in how our water is treated. And it was just optically one of the ugliest moments I've seen, and where I lost all faith in him as a moral individual pursuing moral things, right?
Right. No, and you know, I wasn't support. I didn't mean to convey I was supporting him, but on the in the inside the Beltway model, you know, there's a lot of wretched people. The scale is from 1 to 1,000. So, you know, and I can blame Bush Jr. for tons. I have to go back to Bush Sr. before I start finding someone who I'm willing to say, you know, I'm okay with what I saw there. Mm-hmm. If I could beam presidents forward, I just finished Hoover's biography. Oh my God, he was one of the great ones.
Really?
But he happened to be he's unbelievably impressive. You got to read his biography. He saw the Depression coming. He was trying to head it off at the pass, but he didn't want to let government get big. And so he didn't want these men. And by the way, Roosevelt was a punk, best I can tell. And so, I think Hoover was one of the really great presidents during one of the most wretched 4-year windows. So in some sense, he was like Carter, right? Carter inherited 4 years of disaster.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at that period of time, you had Wilson signing into the Federal Reserve Act, and that was in 1913. 20 years later, the United States defaults and has to cough up all of its gold, which is still held as gold certificates on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. That was the first national bankruptcy right there. Only 20 years it took the Federal Reserve to bankrupt the country. That's pretty fast, don't you think?
Yeah. They really, the fledgling, the youthful Fed got us into a mess fast. And now they think they're smarter. Now they think they know better. Oh, yeah, we won't blow it this time. Right? I promise. No, we won't. We know what we're doing. So, I get in arguments with some Fed heads there. It's not productive, but it's good sparring.
Sure. No, they slayed the business cycle and replaced it with the credit cycle. Whoops. Good thinking on that one. And didn't learn anything from the 2000 blow up, learned even less from the 2008 blow up. I think we're looking at a 2019 to 22 blow up. And by the way,
how do you see the resolution of all this debt?
Massive defaults.
Crudely speaking, deflationary collapse or inflationary wipeout?
I'm a big believer still in the 1998 Eric Jansen of iTulip fame Kapoom theory, which says we have to get some sort of really, really scary deflationary implosion that then brings us to Venezuela-style money for the people, you know, and then run, do not walk, and buy anything you possibly can the minute you see that Fed check show up in your mailbox, which could be a treasury tax holiday, maybe a rebate for last year's taxes too, all of it monetized by the Fed, or your state municipal. Your state municipal program is being bailed out by the Fed, whatever that is. When the Fed begins in earnest to monetize money for the people, that's it. It's lights out, you know, Venezuela in 5 years, set your egg timer. But against that backdrop, we have a 5-year missing oil exploration hole that's going to show up as supply shortfalls in about a 7-year lag.
So we haven't been exploring?
No.
Oh,
2014, 15, 16, 17, we'll have to wait and see what the 18 figures are, but those 4 years are the worst 4 years of oil discoveries in the entire series, going back to 1920.
Our energy independence model is not sitting well with you.
No, longer, more complicated story, but oh my gosh, no. What we did was we took a really important resource and we used it to support 3 excellent years of F-150 Silverado and Chevy Tahoe sales. And it's going to turn out to be one of the worst decisions ever made. Future generations will look back and say, you did what?
And they're getting crushed too, so it's not even like it, there's any stickiness. I owned energy all the way up. I started buying somewhere around 01, 02. But then I held on to it and I got crushed. And then my employer actually booted me out of it. I think it was in May of last year.
Well, that was helpful.
And I didn't even know it. I didn't even know it. And I go, what just happened to my portfolio? Where is everything? And I called them and they said, oh, yeah, we booted a bunch of the funds that are available. We put you into life cycle funds. I go, oh, great. So I basically unwound and just put in the cash. And I said, should I just buy the energy back because we've beaten the crap out of it? Well, it turns out them booting me out of it saved me about 15% so far. So I'm not yet looking like an idiot for not reentering. And that's an irrational investor who's willing to be invested, but when booted out is not willing to reinvest. There is a conflict. There is a conflict, but it forced me to say, would I buy it now? And I said, no. I probably emailed maybe 5 hedge fund managers and said, would you buy it now? This is the dilemma I face. And they all said no.
Yeah, I wouldn't either. Not yet.
And so I'm waiting. I'm going to be buying in the throes of whatever chaos is coming. And I got to figure out what to buy because I do not want to, I don't want to buy AMD or something like that, right? There'll be stuff. There'll be assets, productive assets that will be purchasable, I think, within 5 years at good prices.
I agree. And so I am developing my own buy list. It includes hard assets, real estate, productive real estate. I'm looking at energy, resource, things like that. And there are companies that make sense, but Netflix at a PE of 212. Sorry, not right now.
Yeah. The fangs are not where I want to be right now.
Not right now.
I would like to have been there before.
Absolutely.
I would have sold them is the problem. I would have said, oh, man, these things are nuts. I'm out. And then I would be the guy who, took his founder share of apples and used it for beer money, right? Then I'd really be hurting. So I'd rather have never owned them.
Well, these last year and a half, 2 years has been perhaps the hardest. So 2015-16, I was saying, okay, people, this is it. Head and top shoulder. This is going. And then they just poured the gas on. And then Brexit came. So that was a bad time to let things fall apart. And then Trump was elected, so that was an even worse time. And so they just poured the central banks, just poured more and more fuel on this. And I just kept watching it saying, I can't participate in this anywhere.
I'm only thankful,
Stockholm syndrome. I'm grateful for the 2.8% you can get on 3-month T-bills, Jeez.
Exactly.
Oy, what a sad state of affairs that is.
Yeah, that almost seems like a luxurious cash flow, right?
I know. Oh, my God.
It feels like a refreshing non-zero number.
But I'm really just sucking air at the bottom of the container door, just what little air can come in. It's just awful. So, Well, anyway, hey, Dave, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for writing this year in review. It's the highlight of my year, of so many people's year. So we're going to get it out as widely as we can. And really looking forward to everybody's comments that come with it.
Well, sounds great to me. So I owe you part two, but it's coming real soon. It's written. It just needs – I'm reordering references. I'm 2 hours away, I think.
All right. Well, excellent. So with that, hey, everybody, we've been talking with Dave Collum, professor of chemistry at Cornell, place I actually went to for a brief period of time. And Dave, thanks for your time today.
You bet.